Welcome back to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings on the industry you can regularly read over on The Wrap, and his musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Sunday, March 3rd, 2024, and to be honest, we're lucky to get Mr. Taylor today because you're double booked, right? You need to get out the door to a Robot Dreams panel over in Century City as soon as we get down here, right?
Yep. I did a Q&A at the Arrow a few weeks ago, and now Pablo is back in town, so we're doing more Robot Dreams. And I want to tell everybody that they can see Robot Dreams in a nationwide sneak on Wednesday the 6th. So, Jim, look in your local, see if your local Bijou is playing it, because it is absolutely wonderful. It doesn't come out in wide release until the end of May, so this is just a little sneak for those who are in the know.
So Wednesday the 6th. That's interesting.
Okay. Wednesday the 6th.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll keep an eye out for that. Okay. Thanks for sharing. And more to the point, we should do a better job of letting people know in advance when you're going to be doing this, emceeing, you know, paneling, that sort of thing. Because Mr. Taylor's really, really good at it. You should see him in person at some point. Okay, getting to the news of the week. Got off to kind of a weird start this past Monday, February 26th. News broke that effective immediately, Sean Bailey was out as the president of Walt Disney Motion Picture Studios. I've 15 years at the Mouse House. And you know, Drew, that Bailey was an interesting guy. In fact, if you want to learn more about Sean Bailey, go seek out Drew's March 2017 profile that he did of Sean for Vulture. In fact, what's kind of cool about that is it sort of pops the hood on the thing that really helped Sean make his name at Disney. He was the guy who championed the idea of taking Disney's hand-drawn animated features and turning them into live-action films. And that actually started with Cinderella back in March of 2015, 9 years ago this month. Brilliant strategy, made the company billions until it didn't. I don't know, did the streak go cold, or did people just... I mean, what's your take on this?
I don't know. I mean, you're right that it was every bit as important as a Pixar movie or a Marvel movie, these animated features. He got into office, I think, in January of 2010, and in March of 2010, Alice in Wonderland hit. And that is what got him thinking, oh, maybe this can be a whole, you know, genre. And what's interesting is that you'll read this in the Vulture story if you check it out, but, you know, the Cinderella that they had planned was radically different, and it had her going through the forest, being left for dead, befriending a knight, all this stuff. And then they said, you know what, let's just lean into the classic Disney animated thing. And that's what they did more often than not, and it really paid off. But yeah, you're right. I don't know what, I mean, Little Mermaid made half of what they thought it was going to make. You know, things like Mulan, I think, got kind of caught in the COVID of it all, and same with Cruella. But yeah, I really wonder what the new mindset will be going forward, because there are a lot of these things in pre-production and development.
God, yeah.
You know,
and in fact, the gentleman who's now in charge, David Greenbaum, formerly the co-president of Searchlight, his new title at Disney, is president of Disney Live Action and 20th Century Studios. And I don't know if you saw the thing that was out in the trades earlier this week, but evidently David's mantra going forward when it comes to green lighting projects at Disney is supposed to be, does this movie really need to exist? And that's an interesting question, because there are a lot of movies out there that I don't know that deserve to exist, but on the other hand, you know, that there were so many that are delightful surprises, because it's like, I didn't know I needed this till I saw it.
Yeah, that's a weird way to phrase things. But I do think that he will bring some great energy into the company. I mean, I think that people at Disney really love Poor Things and how Poor Things performed and the Oscar nominations. And so finding that kind of, if they're going to redo them, having that kind of fractured fairy tale bent to it is going to be important going forward. And less the you know, shot for shot Lion King remakes that we saw.
Okay. And forgive me for asking this, but how much of this really is a referendum on the fact that these things seem to have fallen out of favor? And how much of it is making sure that, you know, when Bob Iger is standing, you know, at the podium at next month's annual meeting, you know, while Nelson Peltz makes a run at the board, that, you know, this is yet another thing he can point to, like, look, we've been proactive.
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. But I think clearly, I really love Sean. I think he's like a really lovely guy. And he and I have had a lot of great interactions over the years. Beginning in 2010, did you go to that preview, Walt Disney Studios preview night in New York, where they showed an unfinished Tangled and then footage from Tron?
Yeah. In fact, I was telling the Nathan Grano and that sort of thing that I've only done what I did at the end of Tangled once before, and that was the end of The Little Mermaid when it first came out into theaters in 89. And actually got up from my seat and walked down toward the screen because I wanted to read the names of who had actually done this, who had made this amazing, entertaining movie. And by the way, it's interesting you bring up Tron, because think about it. The two films that bookended Sean's history at Disney are, you know, Tron Legacy, which obviously was released in December of the year he came on board. And they just started shooting Tron Ares? Is that how we pronounce this, Ares?
Yeah, I think they're midway through production in Vancouver on that. So yeah, you're right. It's not that... Not that there weren't other Tron movies attempted in between.
No.
We'll save that story for another
time.
Yeah,
we will.
But yeah, it's interesting that the Tron movies have really bookended his career, because he was an independent producer on Tron and then got hired to run the studio afterwards. And in a lot of ways, I think that Tron Legacy really sums up his tenure at the company, where he was doing things that nobody could quite figure out how to do. In terms of resurrecting old properties, I mean, the two Muppet movies were made under his tenure. A new Wizard of Oz movie, which had always been something that Walt was very keen on, and the studio had tried once before with Return to Oz. You know, he sort of reanimated Disney in a very literal way, until I think that kind of got exhausting for people. And I think that the Disney Plus of it all didn't help either, that we had Lady and the Tramp Pinocchio and Peter Pan and Wendy, which I don't know if you saw, Jim, my story about Paul King's ending to his version of Pinocchio.
No.
Okay.
Because I really wanted to ask you, I mean, you dropped this, you know, as a flyby on last week's show. And they're like, yeah, I got to talk with Paul King, about his version of Pinocchio that he had in the works for years. And it's like,
he was working on that thing for years. Oh. Yeah. So the ending of the movie is, you know, Pinocchio and Geppetto are reunited.
Right.
And Pinocchio is leaving Geppetto's workshop, and he's scared, and he says, I don't know if I can go out there without my strings. And Geppetto looks down at him and says, the strings between us will always be there. And then you cut to black, and everyone's crying, and they have to compose themselves and go get their parking validated.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is the end. You can read that on the wrap.
Oh,
but
man.
I thought that was a very sweet ending. Yeah. But Jim, his version would probably not have had a Toy Story cuckoo clock. So, you know, we got to do the trade-off.
The thing, and I have so much respect for early Robert Zemeckis, used cars, the original Back to the Future, you know, that guy. I love that guy. But Pinocchio particularly was just so cynical, it was one of these things where it's like, who is he making this movie for? And it's like, and you have Tom Hanks. You have Tom Hanks as Geppetto. That should have been an automatic home run.
Yeah.
Though I will say that the Robert Zemeckis version of Pinocchio, you know, does have, honestly, one of my favorite lines of the last 5 years. That whole bit of Pinocchio running down, well, yeah, I went to school, and then I got kidnapped, and then I was in a carnival, and then, you know, and then I got swallowed by a whale, and Geppetto's like, you did all that in a day? You know, it was like...
I thought you were going to say that your favorite line was when the fox says, what are we going to call him, Chris Pine?
Oh, that's what I mean.
Terrible.
That's what I mean.
Terrible.
Okay. Anyway,
terrible.
All right. We have more news to talk about, folks. But before we do that, I want to remind you, the news portion of today's show is brought to you by Touring Plans. If you're headed down to Orlando anytime soon to visit some of the theme parks you'll find there, Touring Plans can help you save time. More importantly, it can help you save money. So before you book that flight to Central Florida, please check out touringplans.com, and you can thank us later. Okay, so we just start off the show by talking about Sean Bailey effectively being pushed out at Disney. Hiram Osmond, on the other hand, is leaving under his own power. He has been at Walt Disney Animation Studios for 20 years. In fact, his first official credit is as an animator on 2008's Bolt. And then worked on a run of very strong, incredibly entertaining animated features, Tangled, Wreck-It Ralph, Frozen, and shorts and featurettes like Prep and Landing, Tangled Ever After, Paper Man, rose through the ranks, was actually the head of animation on Moana, but began this amazing collaboration with friend of the show, Josh Gad, on the original Frozen in 2013, which continued with Frozen 2, as well as Olaf Presents and Olaf at Home, the miniseries. And again, what I love about those last two was that they were produced in the middle of the pandemic, and Josh literally recorded his lines at home at his desk, and Hiram effectively did all of the animation for those things at home at his desk. And they were lovely. They were, I mean, and I was struggling to think of, again, maybe, you know, has there ever been that sort of lengthy collaboration between a voice talent and a specific animator when it comes to, you know, one character like that?
I don't think so. I mean, you're right. That collaboration has been really strong and really special for all these years. But I think you're right that it really cemented it with those COVID projects.
They did.
Which are great.
They did.
And still on Disney Plus.
Yep, they are. They are. And while, Drew and I are both genuinely sad to see this guy go from Disney, but on the other hand, we are thrilled to learn that Hiram is leaving the Mouse House because he's been given the opportunity to direct his own feature. So,
we don't know where. We don't know what feature that is. We will do some digging.
Okay. I'm going to leave that to you and your amazing sources. And by the way, in regards to that last name, yes, Hiram is Donnie and Marie's nephew, but this is a guy who genuinely made him a name for himself in animation through hard work. And he's just an amazing talent. And we are very excited to see what he does next. But again, it's like, where's this guy going? Well, who gave him a shot to direct?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see Frozen 3 and Frozen 4 without him, because he was always a mainstay at press events and explaining how the characters came about and all of that fun stuff. So, a new era.
And as I understand it, the last time he did Olaf was for Once Upon a Studio. Oh, and by the way, did you see there were a couple of gags from Once Upon a Studio that got cut from it that bubbled up online?
I think everyone should be following Trent and Dan on social media if you want to be the first to see these things. I saw they were aggregated by some of those like lost media accounts.
Yep. I love the reprise of the gag from Mulan with Mushu with the gong. It's like, wake up, it's picture time. And come on, cute little animals. And he turns around and there's Scar in the hallway behind him.
Good luck getting Eddie Murphy back for that. That's what I would say, probably.
You're not wrong. Okay. Speaking of Mr. Murphy, who obviously did Donkey for DreamWorks, just a reminder, we're recording this fine tuning on Sunday, March 3rd. On Friday, March 8th, Kung Fu Panda 4 opens in theaters nationwide. And I don't know if you saw that interesting little bit of promotion it did last week with the Kung Fu Panda 4 ad that sort of keyed off of Dune Part 2, you know, that it was effectively Poe walking on the sand planet. But again, smart decision given how well that Warner Brothers Pictures release just released to the box office this past weekend. It's already done, what, $178 million worldwide, and $81 million of that is stateside. But it'll be interesting to see if this will translate into strong box office for Kung Fu Panda. And I guess you would know better than most about this, Drew, because you've actually already seen the sequel, right?
I have seen it, and I thought it was really terrific. I had a great time watching it, and yeah, I really loved it. It's directed by Mike Mitchell, who is a animation vet who has done movies for DreamWorks and did the second Lego movie and has done all sorts of stuff, done SpongeBob movies, everything. And yeah, it's just a really smart, really fun kind of reinvention of the franchise with some great sort of visual flourishes and a great bad guy in Viola Davis's little lizard, the chameleon, who can transform into some familiar villains, Jim, from this franchise's past.
Yeah. Like, what's his name? Kung Lang, the snow leopard, who I love from the first film. I'm so happy to see this character back. Without spoiling anything, I just, you know, want to go all the way back to when the first Kung Fu Panda film debuted. But, you know, on the success of that film, Katzenberg once said that, you know, he envisioned this could be a 6-part saga. And, you know, obviously we're now on the fourth film. We've had a number of animated series. Without giving anything away, do we leave the door open for other movies?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. With a great new addition to the team with Awkwafina's little fox character. She is absolutely great. I mean, yeah, Kikue Kwan, who has had obviously the best year of his life, winning the Oscar for Everything Everywhere All at Once and popping up in things like Loki, which I thought he was so great in. He plays a pangolin, and he is really great. So a lot of great new characters, just great action sequences, and a fun little B story with Po's two fathers going on their own little adventure. Which we love. We love some same-sex parents, and here we go. These guys are out there queering it up on the road, and it is great.
Wow. Okay. I just saw there's a clip out there of the two of them. So what? Climbing the mountainside. I love that interaction.
Yes, I would say go see it too in the theater. Big sound, big screen, very much deserving of that experience. So, yeah.
We'll do. After catching the Robot Dream sneak peek on the 6th. Okay. Now, speaking of Kung Fu Panda, Universal Parks and Experiences seems excited by Kung Fu Panda and seems to think that this is a franchise that will continue. Just in the past week, we got concept art for DreamWorks Land, which will be opening at Universal Studios later this summer. That's all we got, folks. No specific date. Not yet. This is an ambitious reimagining of this theme park's Kids Zone area, which closed back in January of 2023. And, for example, where the Curious George Goes to Town play area once stood, this is where you'll now find Panda Village with Po's Kung Fu Training Camp. And what's interesting, Drew, is this is where you're supposed to be able to encounter a digital Po. Now, can't find out yet whether this is a genuinely interactive thing, like, say, Turtle Talk with Crush, or if these are pre-recorded and pre-animated vignettes. But here, Po is supposed to teach guests kung fu moves while he's babysitting his mischievous cousin, as well as cooking delicious treats. Let's see. Also, across the way is Woody Woodpecker's Nut House Coaster, or whether Nut House Coaster used to be. Now we have the Trollocoaster, which I'm not going to lie is the Nut House Coaster rethemed and repainted. You now will travel in a caterpillar shaped coaster car called a Caterbus. And in between these two things is a Shrek's Swamp Meat. Where guests can meet Shrek, Fiona, and Donkey in a full-sized recreation of his cottage in the swamp, complete with outhouse. And again, Drew mentioned good luck.
I love that there was a bathroom mentioned in the press release. The outhouse. Come for the interactive stuff. Stay for the outhouse.
Well, I've actually asked folks who work the entertainment side of things at Universal, because it would seem to me it would be a gimme that should be how the Shrek, you know, walk-around character should make his entrance, you know, just, you know, have him come out of the outhouse and walk down the hill and immediately shake someone's hand. But it's like, nah, I don't think we're doing that. So now, this area will, in addition to the outhouse, also feature Shrek Swamp for little ogres and got some interactive water play elements. But what's interesting to me, Drew, is what's not talked about, at least when it comes to DreamWorks Land, is the old Universal A Day in the Park with Barney facility. A live show that ran to the park from 1995 through February of 2001. And I know you'll love this, but fun fact, the day in the park with Barney show facility was actually built with a Bates Motel, which had been used for the making of Psycho 4, was located. And seriously, somebody out there has to make a movie where Norman Bates is in a Barney outfit. I'm sorry. You know, that is
actually, I'm a big fan of Psycho 4. I go to bat for all the Psycho sequels, but that one is great. And I remember that reading that production was actually slowed down because they wanted more people to be walking through the set or driving by the set in the tram cars because, again, like Disney MGM Studios, there was a working studio component.
There was.
Which has all but faded away because did you know that Florida is one of four states without filming tax incentives in the country? So they don't even care. Yeah.
That's crazy. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's especially bizarre on the heels of what was the story last week about the tax incentive that California put out there for The Mandalorian and Grogu? I mean, what was it?
Oh, yeah, $22 million. Yeah,
I mean, you know, just, yeah. I mean, I get it. It's California. That's where the studios are and all that. But Florida, really? That's crazy.
Yeah.
With that many studios. Woof.
Hollywood of the East, my big white fan, Jim. Go. That's what I say. You know?
Okay. Anyway, Day in the Park with Barney closed back on January of 2021. May of that year, the DreamWorks Destination attraction opened. This was kind of a super deluxe DreamWorks meet and greet held inside of the same building. And now when we look back at it, this is obviously kind of a concept, you know, so to speak, a proof that, you know, okay, we can get people back in this part of the park with just the DreamWorks characters. Anyway, that closes in January of 2023. And, you know, this is what we have today. But again, that building, I wonder what they're going to do with that at some point in the future. But,
yeah, that's a great question. So, meanwhile, Steven Spielberg has chained himself to the E.T. show building.
Well,
do not come any closer.
Well, more to the point, you saw that epic universe, you know, film, and the fact that Spielberg, they trotted him out. He talked up the new park, and it's like, wow. So he's still getting his kind of admissions, and he's still getting his kind of merch. Yeah, good for you, Steven.
Yeah, I'd heard. What is the stat that like 25 cents out of every dollar spent at Universal goes to him?
My understanding is it's definitely merch, and it's definitely admissions, and it's been that way. Since the project was first announced for Florida.
Since Florida was first announced,
yeah. Yep. Okay, yeah. So getting back to Universal Florida, I'm not sure what happened to that giant Gwen Mallard that was parked at the edge of Universal Lagoon in Orlando as part of that theme park's promotion of Illumination's Migration. That was there.
She's still out here, Jim.
Is she really?
In Hollywood. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, because I know she was there at the park in late December and early January, and haven't heard anything about her. I mean, she's parked down by the water, so they shouldn't have had to deflate her for the Mardi Gras parade or anything like that. So if anybody's seen her in Florida, please let us know. By the way, Migration did okay this past holiday season. Did 123 million domestic, 153 million overseas, worldwide box office of 276 million, and look, a film costs supposedly 72 million to produce, and there'll be, you know, obviously some money spent on promotion, but what is it, the rule of thumb in Hollywood is if if you make three times your production cost, you're in the black, right?
Correct.
So
correct.
All right.
So yeah, so we're good. We're cleared. Did you ever see this movie?
I did not, which is why I have to go out now because and get a copy, because just this past Tuesday, February 27th, the Blu-ray and DVD of this Illuminations movie, Migration, went on sale. So I'll get to see it in my own home. And speaking of movies featuring ducks, now you have to have seen this story about, you know, the one that's making the rounds about Pixar's very first musical, the one that's titled Ducks.
Yes, you'll see that I did not publish anything corroborating this rumor because I've heard that it is, in fact, not the case.
Well, more to the point, I mean, just the fact that somebody is saying Pixar's first ever musical, and it's like, you and I both know, well, that was the Deus del Muerto movie, or at least the original version.
Yes.
Because Bobby and Kirsten and Anderson Lopez did write a full score for this thing. In fact, I think on this very podcast, you've talked about, wasn't the conceit that once you get to the land of the dead, everybody sings 24/7 or something like that?
No, it was that the family was so anti-music in life that they had to sing in death.
There we go. There we go.
So their family was all singing all the time. And yeah, there was a ton of music. Yeah, there were a bunch of songs written. It was very much envisioned as the first Pixar musical. And then the story changed, as happens so often.
It does.
Jim.
And what? They ended up with just the three songs.
Yeah, and I think Adrian co-wrote the actual Spanish songs.
Okay.
I don't think that Pixar thinking about a musical is off base, but it's not whatever this is supposedly.
Okay. That's kind of what I thought. But anyway, as Drew mentioned, this happens in animation. You know, stories change, plans change. And by the way, when we get back from this break, we're going to talk about animated series that Disney once toyed bringing to its syndicated television block, but ultimately opted out of. But first, this. And we're back. Okay, Drew, did you get a copy of the new Van Eaton catalog for the auction that was just held this past weekend?
No, I got invited to. They were doing another one that seemed really, really fun that was called, that actually BioReconstruct emailed us about, which was It Came from Planet Hollywood.
No.
Yeah, they did the preview night. I was telling Jim this off air. Nobody cares out there, but my wife was sick last week, so we could not go. But they did a preview of this upcoming auction that is all stuff from Planet Hollywood.
Oh,
so,
no.
Including stuff that people would wear at the actual restaurant. So if you've ever wanted your crew attire
I wonder if they're selling off the leaking Herbie.
Yes. Well, I mean, as a kid, that really had a lot of mystique to me. And when they opened one up in San Antonio, which is no longer there, but that's where I grew up, you know, it was like every birthday party, we got to go to Planet Hollywood. We got to look at Bruce Willis's dirty wife beater from Die Hard 3.
Spent a lot of time looking at plexiglass or through plexiglass.
Yes, a lot of those were reproductions too, I realize now in my old age, but you know, it was still fun.
Okay, well anyway, the Van Eaton auction that was just held this past weekend, a celebration of Disney Studios and Disney Parks. The reason I bring up the catalog is item 50 or 574 is something I thought Drew would be fascinated by because it was a pitch for a Disney television animated series that was done by animation vet Robert Taylor. He worked on Chippendale Rescue Rangers and Goof Troop. And it was for a show that was supposed to be titled, well, The early version was called Briar Patch Boys, but eventually got changed to Splash Mountain Boys. And yes, Drew, this was an animated series for Disney featuring Brer Fox, Brer Bear, and Brer Rabbit. And for me,
what could go wrong, Jim? What could go wrong?
Well, now here's the interesting thing. Okay, DuckTales comes out September of 87. Now, Song of the South had actually been out in theaters for the very last time in the previous year, November of 86, just 10 months earlier. And supposedly it was put out there because Michael Eisner, you know, was like, I hear this movie's kind of controversial. We want to build up an attraction for the parks around this film and prove to me that it's not going to be a problem. And they put it out into theaters, and Michael waited for the hate mail, which never showed, and, you know, then said, okay, you know, the following month, okay, you got to go build Splash Mountain. But it opens, Splash Mountain, the attraction opens in Anaheim in July of 89, and the Magic Kingdom version opens in October of 92. Obviously, you know, both of these attractions are no more. You know, the Disneyland version opened or closed in May of last year. The Disney World, 5 months before that, January of 2023, and they're now both being transformed into Tiana's Bayou Adventure. But the interesting thing is, on the heels of the success of DuckTales, all the cuffs were off. You know, the notion was, if you wanted to pitch an animated, you know, series for the Disney afternoon block, everybody was up for grabs except Mickey. And in fact, even that changed in, what was it, May of 99 with the Mickey Mouse Works show. But I remember when Disney was putting together Critter Country, the animated series. This was an expanded version of Splash Mountain Boys. You know, it folded in the characters from Country Bear. There was also the Magic Kingdom animated series, and this one had a somewhat bizarre premise in that there was, in the sky, up in the clouds, there was this amalgam or the very best pieces of Disneyland in Anaheim and Disney World and the Magic Kingdom in Florida. And, you know, the characters from the various attractions interacted in their theme park in the clouds. And
there was no Genie Plus up there, because if you went there and you used Genie Plus, you would realize, oh, my God, I'm in hell. I'm not in actual heaven.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that evidently this idea got revisited, a decade or more later. There's some amazing concept art out there for a project called Disney Park Poppers, where it's like, you know, one of the...
I think I went to a party where they were passing those around.
You know, family show. But yeah, that they had this... the shot of like one of the Dapper Dans, one of the hitchhiking ghosts, and I guess a woman dressed as the female astronaut from Disneyland from the 50s, and
with the big fishbowl.
With the big fishbowl. Yeah. So yeah, but yeah, they revisited that idea. Sometimes they, it was tied to like a retail line. There was Thumper's Thicket, that at this point Disney was actually talking about the Disney Bunnies line. That for a time there were books and there were plush, but this was the animated series that sort of to help it along, but it never got put into production. And then there was the Aristocats, the animated series, where Marie, Berlioz, and Toulouse are now teenagers, and
they've all got bad attitudes, and they're riding skateboards around Paris.
There we go. There we go. Now, mind you, one day when I was wandering around where I shouldn't in the Frank Wills building, I did come across some storyboards for the home premiere of the Aristocats 2. In fact, it was a scene where Marie had been tossed off of an ocean liner and was, had to be rescued.
Well, you know, there's a Disney Afternoon book coming out later this year.
I saw that,
from
yes.
D23 edition. Yes. Yeah. So maybe there'll be some of that. I mean, what's so interesting about the Disney Afternoon was that it was pretty short-lived, in part because Bill Mechanic left Disney, went to Fox, and then started the Fox Afternoons, which then he told the Fox affiliates, no way are you running the Disney Afternoon programming block. You're going to run this new one, which had things like X-Men and Batman, the animated series, and things like that.
Well, also remember that didn't they also have their own Peter Pan series, which really kind of ticked off Disney? But it's like, hey,
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But now, when you and I were pre-gaming here, you were mentioning that during your days working at the Walt Disney Company for Oh My Disney, I mean, you saw a few animated series that had ties to Disney IP, right? Or
yeah, I mean, the one that really could have been, and another one that also incorporates multiple IP, was Shannon Tindall's Haunted Mansion show, which people always thought that it was a special, but it was actually a series, and he would encounter things like, again, Herbie, because Herbie is an autonomous vehicle. It was Herbie was actually possessed by some spirit. And I mean, it was going to be awesome, like capital A awesome. And it never happened. But yeah, there were all sorts of things. I mean, at that time, the video games were really popular. So they were looking at things like, remember Toontown, massive multiplayer online thing? And of course, our beloved and equally dead Disney Infinity. You know, these are always things that they were sort of looking at. But
well,
yeah.
By the way, to sort of put an interesting cap on this, in the middle of all of these shows, now Tad Stones, who did a lot of work for Disney Television Animation, he pitched what I think was honestly one of the cleverest ideas that. Maximum Horsepower. You ever heard of this show, Drew?
No. Okay. I love Tad, but yeah. Okay. No.
Well, here's the gimmick. It's think of it. It's the late 1930s at Disney Studios out in Burbank, and Horace Horsecollar, he's been there since the beginning. And the notion is that everybody else is getting Goofy's got his own series now, and Donald's got his own series, and he just hears that Mickey is about to make the jump to features, that he's going to be featured in The Sorcerer's Apprentice and Fantasia, and Horace is just not having it. So he's storming across the Disney lot, and he's going to give Walt what for. And in the middle of the lot, this transporter beam shoots down and grabs Horace and pulls him up to an alien spaceship, and he gets and then travels across the universe because this alien species needs a hero. And evidently Horace was wearing what looked like a heroic outfit at the time, and so he is now their champion, and he agrees that and this is the premise of the show, is they will take him home, because again, he's got to go talk to Walt Disney about getting better parts. He will fight for them or pretend to be a hero to help these folks out. And what's really cool about this is if you Google Maximum Horsepower and Tad Stones, there are four or five different images from the actual pitch reel that Tad put together for this show, where you can see, Horace with the aliens, you can see him with his female lead, the heroic outfit that they sucked him up with, but it would have been a fun idea, but I think, as Drew mentioned, that suddenly it got real for Disney, television animation, what with Batman the animated series, and what you just mentioned, about what was going on over at Fox, with Bill Mechanic, and that's actually where we began to see things, where they began to then you know, okay, let's lean into the actual film. So we got Aladdin, the animated series, Timon and Pumbaa, you know, that sort of thing. You know, they suddenly, ooh, we're going into combat here, so we need bigger ideas. So things like, Chippendale's Rescue Rangers, you know, fell by the wayside. In fact, what was kind of interesting, I remember talking with folks at Television Animation at the time, and evidently Eisner later on, especially during this time when they were talking about Aladdin, the animated series, and Timon and Pumbaa and the like, and, you know, it's like, we should have never made Rescuers Down Under. What we should have made was Rescuers, the animated series, and, you know, brought Ava Gabor and Bob Newhart in and did 65 of those. So, but you never know.
Well, considering how confused and ornery they were about recording, I'm not really sure they would have done a weekly
show. That's an interesting point. Though, the other thing worth noting here is that, again, I was digging down through the pile. And remember, you know, as Disney Television and Animation went on, it began to step away from, from direct, you know, based on old characters like Horse Collar or full films like Lilo and Stitch or Aladdin, and then began to do original properties. And what's interesting is in 2002, Jorge Gutierrez pitched a show for Disney called Pepe the Bull that actually looks very much in the style of El Tigre. Was that his the show?
El Tigre and Maya and the Three.
There we go. And they could have, you know, Disney could have had, you know, one of Jorge's projects. And what's interesting is the entire pilot, I want to say 9 minutes of animation. If you want to see it, it's out there online, folks. Just you know, Google Pepe the Bull. But anything beyond the Haunted Mansion thing, or
the Haunted Mansion. I'm trying to think of what else they were working on, because, like you, Jim, I would always, you know, find myself in the wrong corridor at Disney TV animation.
And
but I mean, that was during the time that they were really leaning into the Gravity Falls and Star versus the Forces of Evil. You know, that was a really great period.
It was.
Amphibia and the kind of sons of Gravity Falls.
No, absolutely. You know, Owl House and the like, and it just.
Yeah, it was a really exciting time, actually, and I think that the Haunted Mansion show would have actually lined up nicely with those others because it had such a distinct personality and point of view. But Disney Animation, Disney TV Animation is just not what it was these days.
But these things are cyclic, so hopefully it'll come back.
Yes. Well, what was interesting, what I was told recently was that, you know, Kid Cosmic was actually a Disney TV animation project. Apparently there was a really intense kind of Gong Show-ish where they would pit two pitches against each other, and the next one would go on and be pitted against another. And so there were a lot of things that did see the light of day later, and a lot of things that you never heard of afterwards because it just died in that gladiatorial arena of Disney TV animation.
I once got to spend a morning with Mike Moon, who for a time was the guy calling the shots at Disney Television Animation. And what's the Star and the Forces of
Star versus the Forces of Evil.
And he showed me that really, really early on, and it was like, oh, this is great. You know, that's like, please, more of these. You know, and
remind me to tell you what Mike Moon's up to these days after we finish recording.
And then speaking of after recording, seriously, Drew needs to get out the door for that Robot Dreams thing. So, we must quickly march to our show close here. So, just a reminder that Mr. Taylor, in addition to the wonderful stories he writes for The Wrap, also has Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, which he does with Charles Hood. And you guys have been recently going through your back catalog of interviews and putting them in the spotlight. So who have we dug out of the archive this week?
I think this week is maybe the 100th episode, or maybe that was last week. I don't know. But the point is that we're clearing these legally. They're now part of the official Mission Impossible podcast catalog. We have some really exciting things that are coming out in March that will be announced soon. So, cool. Yeah.
Okay.
Please don't change that dial.
Don't change that dial. Okay. And we also have some other podcasts here we'd like you to check out. We have, of course, Disney Dish, which I do with Len Testa. We have the Epic Universal podcast that I do with Eric Hersey. And now we have the I Want That Too, which I do with Eric's bride, Lauren Hersey. And in fact, either later today or early tomorrow, Brian Gunn and I will be recording a brand new Looking at Lucasfilm and talking up what's going on that side of the street. And just today, the latest installment of Len and Mai's latest project, Disney Unpacked, our first ever video series, the one we're doing with veteran Imagineer Jim Shule, latest episode just dropped. And this is a history of Rock and Roller Coaster starring Aerosmith. Let's see. All right. Beyond that, well, social media wise, where are we these days, Drew?
Oh, I'm all over the place, but, you know, it's Drew Tailored, like a tailored shirt. Wherever you're online, I'm probably there. So check it out.
All right. Well, myself, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook is Jim Hill Media News. Okay, and one final favor for myself and Mr. Taylor. If you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well, not just this show, but also Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. That helps folks find the show. So, and I guess that's going to do it for now. So thanks for listening, and we will be back next week.